a gentleman who wrote this very fine book that I'm holding in my hand, Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. I speak, of course, of Time Magazine senior editor Richard Zoglin. Pleasure to have you on the show tonight, Richard. Welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir.
Great to be here. Sorry, it was a little late.
Oh, no problem. Glad to have you in. And I found this book very, very, very hard to put down. We don't always have lag time on this show. Sometimes I'll get a book in the mail and somebody will be on in the next day or two. I'm grateful that I had a chance to be able to, to scour through this thing before we got you booked for the show. I loved it. I loved it, Richard. It was great. Let's start at the logical place to begin this thing here. You're a guy who obviously covers many aspects of the entertainment world. What was it specifically that grabbed your interest as far as covering this aspect of it, the stand-up comics of the 1970s
sure.
and what they
Well,
went
you know,
on
I was a TV critic for a lot of years, mm-hmm. and lately I've been reviewing theater, but I always thought that stand-up comedy, I grew up watching stand-up comedy, and I always thought you didn't hear much about stand-up comedians, kind of because it fell between the cracks. It wasn't, TV critics didn't really talk about it, theater critics didn't talk about it, but stand-up comedy was really, an important force in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up. The guys starting with George Carlin, I kind of focused on the generation that I would say coincides with the baby boom generation in the late 60s and into the 70s. George Carlin, Robert Klein, Richard Pryor, and then on into the 70s when guys like Steve Martin were just huge. And stand-up comedy was, as important to my generation, growing up and listening to everything that was going on in the entertainment world as movies or television or anything else. These stand-up comedians helped shape the way we, think about our culture and politics and entertainment and everything else. So that was the generation I wanted to chronicle. So I always thought they had kind of been ignored, and I was the one to do the job.
Well, I've gone back in the course of reading your book. I've also watched some of these guys on YouTube here. What a glorious invention that is! And yeah. Tried to pull that up to try to get some of the flavor of this for some of the guys, because I was alive for some of that time period, but I was awfully young the entire decade anyway. So a lot of this stuff was kind of going over my head as it was happening. What struck me was what you had to say about Lenny Bruce. It was kind of a brave thing to write about him, I thought, in as much as everybody exalts him as being this great influence and everything, and he was. He did show a different way of doing it, but you kind of deconstructed it, and you looked at it and said, and some of this stuff was great. Some of this stuff, really kind of pales in comparison to what some of these other guys came along and did with it later on. That was brave.
Yeah, it's interesting. Lenny Bruce is the guy that most of these guys cite as their major influence, because he was the rebel. He was the guy who pushed the boundaries. He was the guy who showed that stand-up comedy could be social commentary, not just, jokes. But when you go back and look at Lenny, it was kind of primitive sounding in some ways today. Some of the stuff he did, the kind of parodies of movies and some of his political humor, we've kind of gone way beyond it. Now, we couldn't have gone there if he hadn't sort of laid the groundwork. But his stuff today, a lot of it doesn't hold up quite as well in terms of getting laughs.
Yeah, that part of it really was kind of interesting. It's funny because I had a question in mind. One of the things that I had in mind to ask you, I had this in mind before Sunday night and the episode of Mad Men, but that just kind of really drove home even more where I was going to go with this, because you write about in the book the literal decade of the 1970s. Of course, people have a tendency to look at things, in a cultural way that is not as literal as that. Most people will tell you that, quote-unquote, the 2000s began with 9/11. Okay, well, a lot of people will tell you the 60s started with either probably the Kennedy assassination or perhaps the Cuban Missile Crisis, but people generally cite that as that time period up until Watergate, and the culmination of that with everything that happened. I thought of that when I was reading your book, when you were talking about guys like Steve Martin that came along and Andy Kaufman, and you don't spend a lot of time in the book on John Belushi because he's not as noted for his stand-up, but I was kind of thinking about him. These guys who really emerged in the latter part of the 70s, the post-60s part of the 70s, if you will, I wonder if that cultural theory of the 70s lasting from, say, Watergate to the Reagan inauguration, I wonder if that explains why these guys were popular. It seems to me they would have, the way that Steve Martin floundered, as you chronicled, you know, 72, 73, starting to find his footing in 74, these guys really were men of their time period, were they not?
I do kind of combine two eras, actually, because I start in the late 60s,
right.
And I would say the period which we would call the 60s, the social protest era, the Vietnam era. But then it slides into the 70s when, somewhere around the middle of the decade, that kind of hard-hitting political, social-political kind of stand-up, the kind of thing that Carlin did and Robert Klein did and Richard Pryor to some degree, that kind of started to go out of vogue when guys like Steve Martin came along and Andy Kaufman, who were basically, you know, parodying stand-up. They were doing, you know, stand-up comedy that was so bad it was good. They were not. They had no social-political kind of agenda there. They were just doing crazy stuff. And I think that reflected the change in the times when we kind of got tired of Vietnam and Watergate. Once that era was through, I think people wanted to escape, and the stand-up comedians reflected that.
They really did, and it was interesting when you talk about the part of the book that you wrote on the 1960s here. There were a couple of guys that clearly were, you know, emblematic of sort of transitional figures between Lenny Bruce and the guys who came along later. Those would be George Carlin and Richard Pryor, because they started off in the earlier part of the decade. You know, they're doing the Ed Sullivan Show. They're kind of antithetical to where Lenny Bruce is going with stuff. By the latter part of the decade, they're kind of evolving out of that. And by the early 70s decade, I mean, they're full-fledged into where they're going with their new roles and everything like that. And they make very interesting figures in your book in that way.
Right. They both, you know, had parallel kind of careers where they grew up in an era when doing stand-up comedy was doing jokes in front of an audience, you know, in a coat and tie. And they played the game. They appeared on Merv Griffin and Ed Sullivan, both of them. And then they both kind of watched what was happening in the culture and looking at people like Lenny Bruce and say, hey, stand-up comedy can be more than that. And then Carlin particularly talks about how, you know, he was hanging out with rock musicians and he was smoking dope. And he saw a split between his entertainer persona and his real, you know, person that he was behind the scenes. And he decided he couldn't live with that split, so he basically let his hair grow long and he started doing the kind of material that he wanted to do that was expressing what he was feeling. And so that was, you know, they were reflecting a time when entertainment was changing, and it was changing from the old joke tellers to the guys who were making a statement. And those guys lived it. Carlin and Pryor both, you know, lived that change. You could see it in their appearance and their material from the mid-60s to the early 70s.
In the case of Carlin, and this is one of these things where, you know, everybody that reads your book is going to kind of come away with different things here. I was left with a little bit of sympathy for the audiences during that transitional period, because it seems to me maybe the more intellectually honest thing to do is for him to go start playing those beat clubs a little bit earlier and everything like that. It almost seemed like he resented the audiences at the Copa and, you know, the Playboy Club and everything like that. And those people were paying for one thing and getting quite another.
Well, it was a matter of, you know, you got a career going. He's got bookings in places. His agents are kind of booking him in all the traditional places and the places where he has been very successful and people know him. And then inside, he's going through all these changes and he wants to do something different. And he realizes that his material does not fit in the places that he's been booked, but he's got commitments. You know, he's a working stand-up comedian. So he did kind of let it out there, and I do think he might say he treated those audiences a little unfairly. They came expecting the old George Carlin, and he's doing kind of material that they're not expecting, and it didn't go over that well sometimes. And he was kind of resentful of that, and so he was being a little bratty, I would say, maybe.
Yeah.
But it was an expression of, you know, what he was going through, and he was trying to do something that really no one else had done before. What people don't realize is that at that time, what Carlin wanted to do, he had a successful stand-up comedy career. He was playing Vegas. He was on the Ed Sullivan Show. He was on the Tonight Show. And he wanted to totally change and do different kind of stuff and that wasn't suited to those venues. And he wanted to play, you know, colleges and coffee houses. And his agents, you know, and managers are saying, what? You know, this is crazy. And, you know, no one had really done that. There were no comedians who really had a career playing you know, college campuses until Carlin came along. So he really kind of invented a new kind of stand-up comedy career.
He did. And I'm glad you agree with me. I mean, it's not a capital crime, but I agree with you. He was a little bratty to these audiences.
A little bit. I mean, it was very funny. He told me very funny stories about, you know, when he was just, you know, chomping at the bit and didn't want to play the Copa and everything. But, you know, I could sympathize a little with those audiences. They were kind of the victim of that change that he was going through.
Yeah, they're probably sitting there thinking, geez, what did we do to this guy?
But
it's not a capital crime. It's just one of those things that occurred to me. You know, in the course of the book too, you mentioned a couple of appearances that some folks made on the Midnight Special, and that's something that where I've seen some appearances on YouTube, and I think particularly in recent years as they've been pushing these DVDs out there, I think that for folks like myself, where, you know, that might have been a little bit before our time, or I was young, but I don't really much remember watching the show.
Yeah.
That fusion right there with them, with the rock acts and everything like that, that really kind of set the stage for Saturday Night Live and everything else to come as far as the mainstreaming of these acts, didn't it?
Yeah. There were so many venues on TV for these guys to play. And then, you know, Midnight Special. They were all, a lot of these guys were, you know, opening for rock acts too, traveling around the country. So it was really part of the same world. The comedy and the rock world were very similar. And Catch a Rising Star, the big club in New York, where a lot of these comics, you know, worked early in their career, was, you know, kind of a half music and half comedy club. And people like Pat Benatar and people, you know, started out there. And so there was and Mick Jagger would hang out there and so forth. So it was very, the rock world and the comedy world were very close.
It's very interesting, too, because, again, your book, whenever the age is mentioned, you know, of the 1970s and stand-up comedy, I mean, there's the guys that we think of immediately, like, you know, the ones we've talked about thus far, Carlin and Pryor and Martin and those guys. What's also interesting, too, is, and your book delves into this, a little bit of kind of like planting the seeds of what is to come. Because the guys who would go on to dominate the 90s well into the 2000s and the late night wars, Leno and Letterman. You had Leno, who seemed to be going pretty well in his stand-up in the 70s, but wasn't a huge name. Letterman, who you chronicle some real ups and downs with him and some of the struggles that he went through.
Right.
Jerry Seinfeld, just starting to get his feet wet at the time, would go on to become one of the biggest things, if not the biggest thing on TV in the 90s.
Right.
It's really interesting that the 70s, they were all about the big names then and foreshadowing what was going to take over TV in the decades to come.
Right. These guys were all, you know, in the 70s, they were all working their way up in the clubs. And I think those three guys you mentioned, I mean, they really kind of adapted everything that they learned in the 70s and from these kind of groundbreaking comics that I talk about, the Carlin and Pryor and Steve Martin and everything. And these guys kind of adapted various things that those guys did and I think made it a little more mainstream. So they were the guys who really had a good sense of the mass audience, the popular audience. And, you know, Leno did it in his way, and Letterman in his, and Seinfeld, too. And they just sort of figured out how to make stand-up comedy just incredibly popular. And they were the guys that, you know, carried it on. And still today, I mean, those three guys are so huge today.
Well, one of the things, too, and you chronicle this, especially when you get past the point in time of the 1970s and into the 80s and 90s, and the legacy of this period was the ways that stand-up comedians could make their mark. Ironically, as cable TV is coming along, Comedy Central, a 24-hour channel devoted to it, as these things are happening, stand-up comedy, ironically, is becoming a means to an end for a lot of comedians, being able to, you know, get sitcoms, move into that way, whatever. You know, you've got Robin Williams in the late 1970s. Of course, everybody remembers Cosby in the 80s. But you make the point in the book here that really, and a little bit before it happened with Freddie Prinze, the thing with Jimmy Walker was just huge with Good Times in 1974.
Yeah.
Is that the thing that just broke it wide open?
Yeah, in the mid-70s, when guys like Jimmy Walker and Freddie Prinze get sitcoms, that certainly opened up these guys' eyes. Wow, you know, their sitcom being a stand-up is a road to something really big in television. And, you know, in the earlier generation, it's lots of gigs on the Ed Sullivan Show or something, or the Tonight Show, or going to Vegas. But boy, when you got a sitcom, you were at a whole. But I think what happened by the '80s, when guys like Cosby, what was different about Cosby in '84, was the earlier guys, Freddie Prinze and Jimmy Walker, basically were cast in roles in sitcoms that were written. They were, I assume they auditioned and they were cast. Cosby was a case of a sitcom that was totally written around his stand-up persona. And it was such a huge hit that suddenly people like Roseanne and Tim Allen and are having sitcoms that are basically written around them. They're built out of their stand-up persona. And they were very, very successful. So that just made it even more of a kind of gold rush for these stand-up comedians to go out to L.A., work on their stand-up enough so that they could get, noticed by, the agents and get a sitcom. And I think that, in the end, kind of led to this sort of the end of this, golden age that I talk about, because I think the guys were snapped up for sitcoms so fast, it was before they really were able to really develop their stand-up to a great level. And I think that they started to see a lot of the comedians saw stand-up as sort of a road to something else, road to sitcom or movies, But there was less emphasis on stand-up. I think it was more a means to an end. So that, I think, started to damage it a little bit.
Well, and these other opportunities being out there and the chance for things to become a means to an end, that has had a certain permanence to it. That'll never go away now that that's been established. So
sure.
But I wonder what you think in terms of looking at this. I mean, all across the country, we've got great comedy clubs. We've got a great one here in Cleveland, the Improv. I was just there recently, saw a couple of great comics, Don Jameson and Jim Florentine. I mean, there's been a scene that's never really gone away. You talk about in the book that in the 90s it kind of went down a little bit and then and it came back subsequently, after the bursting of the initial bubble. I mean, and everything kind of ebbs and flows. But as we look at this now, are we ever going to see anything, in your estimation, even remotely approaching where it was at with the 70s as far as all of these great talents coming along at the same time, or do you think that that's pretty much not going to be possible?
Yeah, well, I kind of doubt it. There's certainly a lot of comedians out there. The club scene has come back in the last few years. I think there's some good comedians out there. I see them in New York, a lot. I just don't I feel there's a lot of very similar kind of stand-up going on, and I don't see the kind of breakthrough talents that you did in the early 70s when there were so many guys that were so unique and really created their own thing, Steve Martin or an Andy Kaufman. And the guys today, I mean, I think there's some very good ones, but I think we've passed the era when there can be, the kind of breakthroughs that we saw back then. I think, the kind of center of gravity for what's happening in comedy, the cutting edge of comedy, is more, in YouTube videos and stuff. I think that this is more creative stuff, I think, being done on the web and somewhat in the kind of improvisational theater kind of area, some of the more alternative comedy stuff, but straight ahead stand up not as exciting today as it once was, I think.
Well, in a lot of realms of life, Richard, it just becomes harder for a genre to keep reinventing itself. I'll tell you
That's
this,
true.
We're working on a project with the FDH Lounge here, looking back at everything that happened in pop culture and movies and sports and everything in the last decade, and looking ahead to the next decade. And one of the things, upon reflecting on, is looking at the music scene. I mean, aside from the underground, where you've always got new things happening, you look at the mainstream. Geez, what was new this decade? Maybe emo, I'll give you that. Maybe you could throw out another genre or two. Isn't it the same thing with stand-up? It just gets so hard to reinvent after a time.
It's true, it does. And yet, somehow a total another genre will be, where the innovations are taking place. It won't be in stand-up. Maybe it'll be somewhere else. Although stand-up will always be, I think it's kind of eternally refreshing itself. I think right now there's more political stand-up going on. I think there's a lot, and you still see even just watching David Letterman every night, you see that he's continuing to do great stand-up every night in his monologues. So, you know, stand-up is still, you know, right up there at the forefront of what's happening in comedy.
That's true, yeah. I mean, it never will go away. It will continue to endure, whether or not it continues to innovate. It'll always be there, and there'll always, I'm sure, be at least some innovations around the margins. But this book, as we said, is just really great, Richard. Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. We always like to give our guests a chance to plug anything and everything, of course. You've got your work as theater critic and senior editor at Time Magazine.
Right.
Anything you'd like to throw out there in addition to the book?
Hey, well, you know, as long as you're in Cleveland, you know what Cleveland is. The next person I'm going to be writing about is Bob Hope, who was who grew up in Cleveland. So I wonder if anybody, if there's any kind of memory of Bob Hope's early years in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, he's huge here. Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, I was at an Indians game in the late 90s where he was there to throw out the first pitch. I mean, everybody's on their feet. People are weeping at the sight of Bob Hope. Yeah, he's huge here, Richard.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
The venerated favorite son, no question about that. Take a lot of pride in him. This was a great book, Richard. You're a great guest. We loved having you on. We'd love to have you back sometime, sir.
All right, great. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. We enjoyed it as well. Richard Zoglin, everyone.
Thanks a lot.
From Time Magazine, author of a great book, Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America.